And now, Forward with Falk. Join Scranton political observer Dave Falk and WFTE's Jake Rosen as they navigate their way through the political thicket. Well, Dave, we had more America greatness by Donald Trump. He's achieved new records this last week. We had another nearly 3 million unemployed. We're up to 36 million now. The greatest job loss over a 2 or 3 month period in American history. We had a loss in retail sales last month of nearly 15%. We've never had a loss in retail sales that great. We had, it turns out, joblessness among workers who make less than $40,000 a year, namely most workers, is up to 40%. If Trump isn't the greatest failure as president of anybody, or the greatest failure as an executive of anybody, I don't know who is competing with him.
He's in a league of his own.
He's in a league of his own.
Yeah, this is Depression era level numbers.
That's right.
And the thing about it is, when we had the Great Depression back in from 29 into the 30s, that was over an extended period of time. All this has taken place in roughly 8 weeks.
That's right.
So the way to measure it, there just is no way to really measure this thing. It's going to take historians years to try to figure this out, economists years to figure it out. The acceleration in the rate of things happening is enormous. And, of course, nobody knows what kind of a realignment of American life is going to occur coming out of this. We're already seeing in the retail sector the upscale store like Neiman Marcus filing for bankruptcy, and the more pedestrian store like JCPenney filing for bankruptcy.
116 years they managed to stay in business through God knows how many depressions and recessions, but they succumbed to this one.
And that's because of the rapid rate at which this occurred. There was no way to adjust for it. And I saw some analyses going on this week about retail. Don't forget, these places are the shops, the physical shops. They're sort of frozen in their inventory at the spring. And if and when they get back, they're not going to have the inventory, or they're not going to be able to afford to upgrade their inventory towards the seasonal nature of a lot of their businesses. The customers are not going to be coming back in the same way that they did. We're seeing a lot of online sales. The Amazons are doing well. But even there, there's questions about how long that can be sustained by people who aren't working.
And there's one thing I forgot to mention. As of this weekend, we have in excess of 82,000 dead. And of those 82,000 dead, the studies that have been done by the leading public health officials say 90% could have been avoided, were totally avoidable, had the proper social quarantine measures been introduced. So in other words, let's assume they're wrong, and 90% is wrong. Let's say only 80%. So instead of 82,000 dead...
Well, actually, it's closer right now to about 88,000, as we're speaking. It's closing in on 90.
Well, in that case, at 90,000 dead, you could say that 80,000 of those dead are directly attributable to Trump's lack of action, refusal to take action. And that's 90,000 he's responsible for. More than all the dead of the Vietnam War, the Iraqi War, the Afghanistan War, and the Korean War, all put together. Now, that in any rational world, a guy like that would be considered a traitor.
Yeah, but this is not a rational world. No. If it was a rational world, he wouldn't have been elected in the first place.
No, but I mean, even if he was elected, a guy gets elected and he's responsible for 80,000 deaths because of his policies, you get rid of him. The country should be in an uproar. The papers should be saying, quit. There should be demonstrations up and down Washington no matter what the health risks are, because the risk of dying is greater. In World War II, people who said the invader was not dangerous, which is what Trump says about this invading virus, it's not dangerous, those people were considered collaborators with the enemy. And after the war, they were executed. Quisling, that fellow's name became a loathsome curse word for generations because he was a collaborator. Trump is a collaborator with the virus.
Yeah. The thing is, and I go back to maybe the sociology of this, the way it's going down, you know, we have clusters. We're having people in nursing homes. We're having people in meatpacking plants getting the virus. And the spread of it or the array of it is not anywhere near uniform. And we also have another phenomenon here is you're not seeing the funerals. These people are dying anonymously, and they just become a number rather than something more easily seen. You don't have the processions down the street of hearses, and you don't have people gathering in churches or what have you to try to comfort the family and seeing the grief. The families are grieving alone, and so the perceptions, I hate to say it, but they appear to be different. The families know what happens, and they know the hurt and the harm, but the ways of expressing this or the ways of getting it out into the kind of mass action that you're talking about, I think, are being prohibited by the very nature of what this is. It is not a shooting war. It is an infectious, a pandemic of an enemy that isn't seen. You just don't see this. So in that way, it's somewhat different. But yeah, the numbers are that. And of course, the hypocrisy and the types of rationalizations that we see going on among the Trump supporters are enormous. The ones that want to open up the economy and what they're trying to do. If you remember when the Affordable Care Act was being debated, there was that provision in there that they wanted to have money set aside so that doctors could talk with families about end of life care. And that's all it was. It was a discussion of options that people had, whether it be palliative care, hospice, or whether it would be that the family wanted to have more aggressive types of care and what the probabilities were. And the Obama people were excoriated.
That was Sarah Palin's big thing, death panels.
Death panels, you know, you're killing grandma.
Yeah.
And now, openly, you have Republican politicians, primarily Republican politicians, like the people down in Texas, the governor, the lieutenant governor, the attorney general there, saying that, people are going to die, but so what? And if it's killing grandma or grandpa, so what? They're going to die anyway.
But everybody's going to die anyway.
Sure. There's something else, though, that really, you know, they're trying to divert attention. They're grasping for things. They're talking about the Sweden model, where they've because there is no neither a cure nor a vaccine for this virus. So that the one thing they're talking about is herd immunity, which generally requires at least 60-70% of the people being infected by the virus.
Yeah, you're making a good point because, first of all, herd immunity is a concept for herds, not for humans. It's for bovines. That's where the concept originated. It's interesting that they should take this animal husbandry term and apply it to human beings. That's one thing. But the other thing is this. Spain is a country that had the greatest proportion of sick people to population in all of Europe. And it turned out that that was 5%. They did a lot of testing in Spain. And in Spain, there were something like a quarter of a million deaths for 5%. You extrapolate that, let's say, to the United States, you're talking about 2 million people would have to die if you got herd immunity at a 50% rate. In other words, if 50% of the population, not what you said, 60 or 70, make the numbers easy, 50%. At 50%, you need 2 million people to die to achieve herd immunity. That's a hell of a solution.
Yeah, and there's something else that's developing as well, because everybody is looking at this deaths versus infections that don't result in deaths. But we're starting to find out with this virus that there's a whole danger in the middle. People who don't die but become terribly sick. We now have this syndrome in children that they've never really seen before. It's mimicking something called Kawasaki's disease, where after the children have had an exposure to the virus, apparently have even a mild case of the virus, that something happens to their immune systems that comes back and causes severe reactions from lack of circulation in the limbs to heart defects to the lung problems. And no, there have not been that many deaths among young children, but there's still, we don't know what the long-term effects on their health are going to be. And then people in the middle, the middle-aged people, they're starting to see things like blood clotting, strokes, organ failure, organ damages. And again, you don't know what's going to be the long-term effects. Are these people going to be permanently disabled in some respects? For kids, is their ability to grow or function going to be somewhat impaired over their lifespans? There are so many unknowns, but more and more things emerging about this that to suggest that the best thing is just to let the course run its or the disease run its course is fraught with all sorts of other problems.
But that is Trump's plan. That is what Trump is proposing, because he's saying two things. First of all, he's saying the death numbers are wrong. The statistics are wrong. He's beginning an attack upon the statistics. Don't believe him. Don't believe what the scientists, the doctors, the epidemiologists say. Believe me.
Don't believe the coroners.
Yeah, don't believe the coroners. Don't count. The numbers are wrong. So that's number one. Number two, he's ginning up his base to turn out by saying we got to restore normal life. Let's get everything working normally again, as if that were possible. And so we have an upsurge of people demonstrating, mainly very small numbers of people, but with very large amounts of publicity, groups made up principally of anti-vaccination types and former Tea Party types, demanding that they should have the right to do what they want to do, get drunk, go to tattoo parlors, congregate wherever they want to do. That's what they should do. With the result that COVID-19 is now spreading to areas not in the centers of the big cities, but less populated areas like where we live, like Lackawanna County, like Susquehanna County.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a demand in Pennsylvania. The county should go from red to yellow. In other words, the most regulated to less regulated, yellow. And it turns out that the number is, if you have the tipping number is 1 in 1,000, 1 case per 1,000. If you reach less than 1 case per 1,000, you should go from red to yellow. And Susquehanna County, my county, is going to go to yellow next Friday. Susquehanna County doesn't have 1 case in 1,000 population. It has 1 case in 500. It has twice as many cases as are required to go from red to yellow. Your county, Lackawanna County, has won in 165 cases as of this weekend, 6 times more than should be the number that they say the number is to go from red to yellow. So you have to ignore all of this. You have to put people at risk of their lives in order for Trump to get himself reelected.
Well, there's two other things I want to say about on this. First of all, Trump came to Pennsylvania this week, as you know, down in Allentown, to hold some sort of a photo op, quasi pep rally, whatever you want to call it, at a business that was making some of the PPE supplies. And he uttered a statement that is incomprehensible to people who understand normal logic, but among his supporters probably makes sense. And what he said is, we've got the most number of cases in the world because we've done the most number of tests. And if you don't have the tests, you don't have the cases, which is, of course, completely backwards. You know, the tests don't cause the cases. And you know, the Twitterverse was full of these things. Hey, let's stop doing glucose tests and we can get rid of diabetes. Let's stop doing PET scans and we can get rid of cancers. Let's stop doing pregnancy tests and we can get rid of unwanted pregnancies.
Don't count automobile accidents. There won't be any.
There won't be any, yeah.
That's 50,000 people killed. That would be great.
Yeah, that was the one thing. And the other thing is, Trump has put, and there's nothing wrong in this, trying to put a pedal to the metal on vaccine development. Now, whether they're competent enough to do it properly, who knows? There are a lot of different things out there on vaccines. But most of the experts say that it would be late in the year, if not early next year, till we have, at the best, and we could be a year to year and a half away from a good vaccine, provided, of course, that the virus doesn't mutate.
By the way, having a vaccine doesn't mean you've produced the vaccine in quantity. Right. It just means you've identified something that could be produced in quantity.
But, yeah, and there's something else, and we keep talking about herd immunity, is that there's a large number of people, particularly among Trump followers, who don't want to take the vaccines. They don't believe in vaccines.
No, they think it'll kill you. The vaccine will kill you.
The vaccine will kill you. You know, the people who don't have, who no longer suffer from polio, or who no longer suffer from other
rheumatic fever, mumps, is gone.
Yeah, all those things that
measles
are gone.
Used to be gone.
It used to be gone until people stopped taking vaccines for it.
Yeah.
Things like that. Smallpox is gone. All of those things. A lot of people say we're not going to take it anyway. You know, it's our right and our freedom not to do it. And this battle has been going on, you know, it was going on with measles for a long time, because there was a phony study out of Great Britain that said that the measles vaccine caused autism. And it got picked up by people. I mean, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is one of them that's been disavowed by his family on this issue. You know, there's this tendency of people not to want the vaccines. I would like to see somebody at one of Trump's press conferences saying, Mr. President, you want to develop a vaccine, and we hope that it's developed quickly. When it's developed, will you become the first person to take that vaccine? That should be the question to him. Will you do it publicly? Mm-hmm. Will you roll up your sleeve and show all these people leadership by being the number one to do it?
I think you should broaden it. You say, well, you and Vice President Pence.
Pence, yes.
Because Pence's base is especially anti-vaccine.
Yeah. Of course, I think the first thing he'd say is, well, I'm going to have Vice President Pence do it.
Let him do it first.
Let him do it first. Let him do it first. You know, that's what a vice president is for. He's the food taster, right?
He's the food taster, exactly.
You know, I mean, you can't this stuff. And of course, a lot of this is it's what they call day trading. It's one thing after another. There have been other things that have happened this week that we really need to talk about.
By the way, something that we haven't talked about, but I don't know if you noticed it. Do you know that there was a conference called by people, lawyers, people like you, who are not like you, experts in election law, to discuss? This is a serious nationwide conference they had via Zoom. What would happen if Trump loses the vote and refuses to leave office. What would happen if the vote was essentially tied in a number of places in some battleground states, and the Republican legislatures in the states where there were Democratic governors issued their own list of electors, and the Democratic governors issued his or her list of electors? So you would have competing claims to legitimate election. What would happen?
Well, that's the Bill Maher question. He's been talking about this for a long time. And
there's no law. Apparently, there's only one law that governs. It's something passed in 1875 that has been applied a few times. But, you know, first of all, it's a law. It's not an army. And second of all, it's very, you know, there's no clear precedent.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, you get back to, this is something akin to the election of 1876, the Tilden Hayes election.
That's right.
Where they wound up having
passed,
a commission over Louisiana.
It was passed in reaction to that situation.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I'm not sure, but it's going to be a fight. I tell you one thing, though. If Trump loses and he's making noises, the first thing Biden ought to do is get on the air and say, look, January 20th, 2017, I'm going to be at the steps of the Capitol. I'm going to be sworn in as president. And Don and Melania, you're invited. But I'm going to be in that White House when we come back from the Capitol. And he better stand up, you know, strongly for that. A lot could happen between now and then. Not going to happen between now and then. We'll just have to see. You know, this we've got 6 months to the election. By the way, I was told this week that the Lackawanna County Voter Registration Office has been swamped with absentee ballot requests. Absolutely swamped.
I think it's true for the whole state.
Yeah. And that's because last year they changed the law that took it from a very narrow way to a very narrow.
Well, you used to have a medical reason or you had to demonstrate that you were going to be out of the state. Now you just have to ask for it. You just have to say, I want to vote absentee.
Right. I did that. My family did that. We sent our ballots in this week. So, and I'm on the ballot, by the way, for a Democratic convention. You know,
you're going to be elected to be a candidate to a convention that's not going to take place. What kind of a victory is that?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of things that aren't taking place that should be taking place this year. This weekend, President Obama is going to do a high school commencement address to the nation because all these high school and college commencements have not taken place. It's just this is a unique period in American history, and there's nothing else you can do. I don't know. Matter of fact, Trump is making noise that he may not hold the Republican convention, or he may not hold it in North Carolina, or trying to blame the Democratic governor there. Who knows? Who knows what's going to happen? There's a lot in between between now and then that we really should talk about. You know, you talked about whether if there's something that, you know, the vote, who's going to decide it, you know, there's going to be court cases. And there was some court action this week that we really should mention. The Michael Flynn case is one where they're trying to do an end around his conviction or his guilty pleas on this and trying to prevent Trump from having to pardon him. So Bill Barr came up with a unique way of saying that we're just going to drop the charges. But the judge has to approve that. And this judge is not going quietly into that good night. This week he asked a retired judge to actually write a brief or to take the position of prosecutors who no longer wish to prosecute. And as a matter of fact, a couple thousand prosecutors and former prosecutors signed a letter saying Bill Barr should resign. So we don't know what the judge is going to do. The judge has an option. He can still sentence Michael Flynn. He can say, I'll agree to drop the charges, but I'm doing so without prejudice, which means they could be refiled. He could do it with prejudice, which means that the case is over. We don't know. He could hold Michael Flynn, as he's threatened, to hold him in criminal contempt for lying to the court. for taking a guilty plea on something that he says I'm not guilty on. That's a lie under oath. That's what Bill Clinton got impeached on. So there's all sorts of things there. And we had arguments in the Supreme Court, by the way, in which Clarence Thomas again took part after spending years not asking any questions. He was very active this week. The one case was, there were two cases consolidated about whether or not Trump has to produce his tax records or whether his accountants have to produce his tax records. One for a congressional committee. And I have to tell you that the lawyer for the Congress did not do a great job. And they got caught up in, well, what ifs could happen rather than the very simplistic question is, this is a mandatory type of situation that the Congresses have always been able to do. And the other
the
was
issue is pretty simple. I mean, the question has nothing to do with Trump in a certain sense. The question is the president accountable to the law? Right. Or is he not accountable? Right. The president, Trump's position is, as long as he's president, he is not bound by law. Period. Right?
Yeah. And they took that position in the second case, which was the criminal case in New York State over possible tax fraud, I think it was, where the prosecutor there was asking for records, again, not from Trump himself, from his accounting offices. And that argument did not go very as well for the president. The justices there didn't seem to buy that absolute immunity argument, particularly since we've had, President Nixon and precedent with Clinton on the books. Although the Supreme Court, particularly with Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, don't seem to think that. Gorsuch in particular seemed to think the precedent is something that you don't really have to follow anymore. So we'll have to see where they go, where these cases go. Those decisions will be out in June. I think what they're going to wind up doing is making a finding that requires it to go back to the lower courts and be relitigated through that. And by that time, the election's going to be over and Trump's going to be protected on his tax returns. But he may not be protected from prosecutions. That's what I see. And, speaking of being prosecuted, we had the senator from North Carolina, Richard Burr, who was the head of the Intelligence Committee, and his cell phones were confiscated by the FBI over some sales he made of stocks the Intelligence Committee got a briefing on what was going to happen with the virus.
$2 million. He sold $2 million. He didn't sell a dollar's worth of stock. He sold $2 million worth of stock.
Now, the interesting part is we don't know what, if anything, they did with the senator from Georgia, Kelly Loeffler.
Who sold also more.
She had even more. But the Burr thing was, they think, is more of the politicization of the attorney general's office, because Burr has issued reports, his committee has issued reports that undercut what the Trump administration has been saying about Russian interference in the election. And as a matter of fact, they've had five reports. The fifth one Burr signed off on before formally resigning as the chairman, or taking a leave, I should say, as chairman of the Intelligence Committee. So that thing came up this week. And we'll have to watch that and see where the Intelligence Committee goes on investigations. But meanwhile, the Republicans are still sweating out the Senate races, which many of which seem to be turning against them in places they didn't expect to have to defend.
Well, we'll have to see what happens. We're coming to the end of our discussion for today.
Yeah.
We got plenty. We didn't even get to talk about the Democrats' relief bill that they introduced and passed through the Congress. But we'll have time to talk about it next week, and I'll see you next week.
We'll see you next week. Stay safe, stay well.
Right. Bye. You've been listening to Forward with Falk. Longtime Scranton political observer Dave Falk and WFTE's Jake Rosen discuss politics. Join them again next week, same time, same place. This program is supported by Argosy Bookshop of New York City. 116 East 59th Street, just down the block from Bloomingdale's. Old and rare books, prints and maps, members of the International League of Antiquarian Booksellers, founding members of the Antiquarian Booksellers Association of America, members of the Appraisers Association of America, on the web at Argosy Books, ArgosyBooks.com. Check them out for books, autographs, maps, and prints.